Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The White House on guns, Congress on the debt limit, and Dreamliners on the ground. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday. It's the 16th of January. And as promised, the president laid out his plans for new federal gun control measures today. He wants background checks for basically all gun purchases. He wants a ban on military-style assault weapons and limits on high-capacity magazines. He also did what he can do without Congress. He signed 23 executive orders on everything from encouraging schools to hire police officers to ordering the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to do new research on gun violence. That last one, the president said, is because when it comes to guns and gun violence, good data is really hard to find. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura gets us going today.
This goes back to 1986 when the Firearm Owners Protection Act became law. Bob Spitzer teaches political science at SUNY Cortland and has written four books on gun control. He says that law rolled back a lot of gun restrictions. Ammunition dealers didn't have to keep records.
It also made it easier for individuals to buy and sell guns and to sell guns without a license.
There are no records of those sales. None of them require background checks. The law also placed new restrictions on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in response to criticism from dealers and gun owners groups that the ATF had overstepped its authority.
Even today, the ATF, when they receive calls to do background checks, have to rely on paper records in boxes as opposed to a computerized system, even though every agency, office, and organization, and practically individual in the country, has and uses computers.
The ATF can't collect certain kinds of data, and it's not allowed to make some data available to the public. In 1996, Congress eliminated federal funding for the Centers for Disease Control's research into firearm-related deaths. Congressman David Price is a Democrat who sits on the House Appropriations Committee.
It's basically shut down a lot of relevant research on gun violence and its place in public health.
And that decision, he says, had a chilling effect on all kinds of gun-related research. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a strong advocate of strict gun controls, mentioned it at a conference on Monday.
Congress has no business dictating what public health issues scientists can and should study.
The CDC has a $6 billion budget, Bloomberg said, and out of that, $100,000 went to firearms injury research. To this day, the agency can't do anything that could be construed as advocating or promoting gun control.
It's a really big issue.
Matthew Miller teaches public health at Harvard, and he says the absence of good data makes his job difficult.
It's very hard to tell my students that they should go into firearms research because there's no funding.
Today, President Obama called on Congress to help researchers like Miller.
We don't benefit from ignorance. We don't benefit from not knowing the science of this epidemic of violence.
The president asked Congress to fund more research into gun violence and to look for links to violent images on TV and in movies and video games. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There was, to change gears just a little bit here, news of tidy corporate profits today. J.P. Morgan Chase said profits rose 53% last quarter over the year before. Record annual profits for the third straight year to boot. Goldman Sachs said pretty much the same thing. So clearly, big banks are doing all right. But what, if anything, can their profits tell us about the actual economy? Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has that for us.
It's like the good old days. Never mind that $6 billion trading loss at J.P. Morgan Chase or settling with the government over bad mortgages. The money is pouring in. So can we all just relax now? Economy's back in shape?
All you can tell from J.P. Morgan Chase's and Goldman Sachs's earnings is that they're doing very well.
Oh, William Cohen is the author of Money and Power, a book about Goldman Sachs. He says these stellar earnings are partly because there's less competition since the financial crisis. J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs are considered the cream of the banking crop and are sucking up business. And he thinks the banks are propped up by government policies that keep interest rates low.
It's like a morphine drip in the arm of the credit market.
But that trip does appear to be helping the economy in some ways. J.P. Morgan's earnings showed more credit card spending and more business and mortgage lending. Economist Mike Mebs thinks homeowners will have extra cash as more refinance at lower rates.
That's going to help offset the reduction due to the Social Security increase, which is affecting all wages and salaries.
Still, the economy seems fragile. Banking analyst Nancy Bush says she's not hearing much optimism.
There seems to be a reluctance on the part of these bank CEOs to say, look, a much better economy is clearly on the way.
And even though J.P. Morgan's earnings were solid, its CEO Jamie Dimon will be earning less. The bank cut his pay by half following that big trading loss last year. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Following up on that last bit from Dan about Jamie Dimon's pay being cut, that's the London Whale fiasco from last year, that six-something billion-dollar loss on questionable trades. As Dimon himself put it this morning, that was one huge, embarrassing mistake. And as a result, Mr. Dimon's total compensation is now just $11.5 million, down from $23 million the previous year, which will, we imagine, lead to some belt tightening in the Dimon household.
Judy, girls, I've got some bad news.
Honey? Dad?
Not another one of those, whatchamacallit, financial crisis.
No, not that. Not for the rest of the country anyways. This is embarrassing. It's the board.
Darling, you're not saying they cut your payback to 2010 levels?
I'm afraid it's worse. Not as bad as that sucker panned it, but we're not going to have much cash on hand.
So what are you saying? Does that mean we lose our bonuses too?
Afraid so, sweetheart. And your clothing and travel budget has to come down at least 20%.
Are you kidding me? A measly $5,000 a quarter? That's barely going to cover the essentials. Is this what we've been reduced to?
Honey, I know, but it's just this year.
What other surprises are there then?
Just this one. No more designer dogs.
No!
Actually, just kidding. We're still really, really rich. We don't have to change a thing.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with that dog. The Federal Reserve came out with its beige book today. It's once every now and then look at what's going on in the economy, broken down by regions. We're doing all right, by and large. The debt limit did have an effect, the Fed says, on growth. But here is my all-time favorite line from an economic publication, bar none. It comes from the Boston Fed, and this is a direct quote. Sales of frozen fish continue to be weak. On Wall Street today, weak as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is Wednesday. There must be news of the debt limit. And in fact, there is. Today, New York Democrat Gerald Nadler introduced a bill to get rid of the debt ceiling. Just make it go away, which does kind of seem almost too easy. Congressman Nadler, good to have you on the program.
Good to be here.
You came out early, sir, in support of the trillion-dollar coin, an idea that was ill-fated, perhaps. You now have this legislation to repeal the debt ceiling, which will have a tough time, I think, passing Congress. What's the point you're trying to make?
The point I'm trying to make is that the debt ceiling has been weaponized. It was superfluous. All the debt ceiling does is allow the United States to pay the bills. The bills incurred as a result of congressional voting last year, the year before that. By threatening not to raise the debt limit, to cause us to default unless the Congress or the President does what the Republicans in the House want him to do, in effect, what that's doing is blackmailing the American people, like a 1930s gangster movie. That's a nice economy you got over there. Pity if it should blow up.
On the theory, Congressman, that the debatable theory, I'll grant you that, that the Republicans are negotiating from a perceived position of strength, do you think the Democrats are ready to have any conversations about Social Security reductions and Medicare reform and all those things that might help control
well,
spending?
Well, I certainly hope we're not prepared to discuss Social Security reductions, although apparently the president is to some extent. Medicare we're certainly prepared to discuss as long as we're not talking about reductions in Medicare benefits. But we should not be prepared to negotiate at the point of a gun.
Do you realize, Congressman, do you and all of your colleagues, both in Congress and at the White House and everywhere else in official policymaking in Washington, do you realize how you come off to the American people?
Well, I think Congress comes off terribly. And it's right. And The basic reason for that, well, there have been two reasons for that. One is that the Senate has been hamstrung by the filibuster. A minority can block anything, so the Republicans can block anything, the Democrats can block anything.
Congressman,
But the second thing is, in the House, you've got a bunch of extremists in the Republican Party who are intent on blackmailing the American people to get what they want because they think they are right, and compromise is a dirty word.
Let me see if I can get you to answer this question again without using the words Democrat or Republican. This is not the way responsible people deal with difficult problems, sir.
That's right, but only one party is being really irresponsible here, and it takes two to tango. So I don't think you can honestly answer that question without reference to Democrats and Republicans.
What are we really going to do after your bill goes for a vote in the House and is defeated, because it inevitably will be? What are you really going to do to fix the debt limit in this country?
Well, it's not a question to fix the debt limit. The debt limit must be increased. There's no way around that. And the president, by saying he's not going to negotiate, is right. Now, he's got, I think, two ways around the debt ceiling. If it comes to that, one is invoking the 14th Amendment, and the other is the platinum coin option.
Which are not going to happen. He has said that's not going to happen.
Which the president has said is not going to happen. But I wonder if the Republicans do not back down, faced with a depression, if the president wouldn't reconsider that.
I guess we'll see.
I would certainly urge him to.
Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat of New York, he introduced today a new bill called the Full Faith and Credit Act of 2013 to get rid of the debt limit. Congressman, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I'm tired of dreams. I'm tired of what we mean when we tell kids, particularly the ones who seem to be up against the most insurmountable odds, to dream big.
A look back at that now so politicized word, hope. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 23 points today, a tenth of 1%, closed at 13,511. The NASDAQ added 6 points, 0.2%, ended at 3117. The S&P 500 was flat, basically ended where it started. So Goldman Sachs' big jump in profits, they converted that to a 4% gain. J.P. Morgan also reporting higher profits, as we mentioned, banked 1% today. Comerica, which is a commercial lender, added 3.7%. Smith & Wesson is one of the few publicly traded gun companies out there. The pistol maker was up 5.5% today. Sturm Ruger is another one. Its shares also notched a 5% gain. Alliant Tech Systems makes gun accessories and a lot of ammunition, down 1.6% today. Consumer prices flattened in December, helped by declines in prices for fuel and food. But Chipotle Mexican Grill slumped more than 5.5% today after warning higher food costs are holding down its earnings. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of December. The annual winter meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors gets underway in the nation's capital. Gun control and school safety is one topic on the agenda. And earnings season continues with reports from Intel and Citigroup. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Well, the news goes from bad to worse for Boeing. It comes in the form of something called an Emergency Airworthiness Directive, which sounds ominous and, in fact, is. The FAA has grounded all U.S.-registered Boeing 787 Dreamliners. At the moment, that applies only to United Airlines. The worry, of course, is over the fire risk associated with batteries in that next-generation aircraft. Matthew Wald covers aviation for the New York Times. Matthew, good to have you with us.
Hi, Kai.
So how bad is this? I mean, it sounds bad, bad, bad.
Well, Boeing's out there pushing the envelope with a new airplane with a lot of new technology on it, and it appears they may have pushed slightly too hard in one area. I suspect they'll get this cleared up, but for the time being, they got problems. They've got 800 or so orders for these airplanes, and they're hoping to get a lot more orders, and this doesn't look good for them.
For the time being, you might imagine being how long until they can fix this and satisfy the FAA that this plane is safe?
Well, At this moment, I don't think you can say with certainty what's gone wrong, except that they've had a single type of battery in two different locations on the airplane get some kind of thermal reaction where it just gets too hot. Either it starts to smoke or it's an actual fire, and they need to replace that with a battery they have more confidence in, and that may take a while, but first they got to chop up the damaged batteries and see exactly what went wrong.
Wouldn't you have thought they would have taken these batteries apart a while ago, let alone in the development and engineering process?
Well, I was just looking at this. You remember a few years ago, Sony had built millions of laptop batteries that got recalled. The Chevy Volt that burst into flames 3 weeks after a crash, arguably not the world's greatest safety problem. But it turns out as lithium-ion batteries get bigger, they have more trouble giving off their excess heat. And if they've got some flaw in them, either in heat removal or in the way they generate heat, you can run into trouble, and you run into bigger trouble and trouble faster and more often with a bigger battery. As lithium-ion batteries go, these are pretty big. Your cell phone and BlackBerry use these, but those are small and can't make so much heat. So I would say that they probably went through special precautions in building these things, but those precautions may turn out not to have been adequate.
How unprecedented is this?
The FAA has grounded lots of airplanes, sometimes after a crash. The DC-10, the engine came off at O'Hare in, I think, 1979. Yep. Recently, it grounded dozens of 737s after Southwest Airlines hadn't inspected them properly, and scores of MD-80s and MD-90s owned by American Airlines after they had some generic problems with wiring bundles. It's a little unusual to ground a new airplane, but it's not unprecedented.
You're a science and aviation guy, so this is kind of a trick question, but I'm looking at the stock ticker here on my computer in the studio. Boeing shares off 3.8% today, another 2% in after-hours trading after this news has broken. What does this do for this company that's got 800 of these orders waiting in the hangar?
When you build a new airplane, because it's so expensive to develop it, you're coming close to betting the company every time you come out with a new airplane. So this airplane pretty much has to be made to work. But that's not to say that it won't be made to work. That's not to say they won't find the problem, fix it, and have a very successful commercial product afterwards. They just have to get all this done.
What then happens to Boeing customers who are waiting for these planes? It's not like they can go to their choice of aircraft suppliers, right? You got Airbus and Boeing, and that's it.
That's true. And also, the 787 has tremendous attraction for airlines because it pushes the envelope, because it carries a passenger more miles on a gallon of fuel. And there are airlines that are reluctant to be what's called the launch customer.
Yeah.
They'd prefer to be second or third or fifth in line. The airlines typically take delivery of these things over an extended period. If you're far down in the queue, you're probably well assured that this is going to be worked out by the time your turn comes up. If you are unlucky enough to own all Nippon Airways owns 17 of them, Japan Airlines owns 7. After that, you're down into lower numbers. Then you're going to have operational problems for some short period, at least.
Matthew Wald covers aviation for the New York Times, and the news today that the FAA has grounded the new Boeing 787s on those battery fires. Matthew, thanks a lot for your
time. Thanks, Kai.
See ya. There's been quite a change in the flow of migrants back and forth across the Mexican border. For the first time in 40 years, there are now as many Mexicans going home as there are coming to the U.S. Part of that is because of the sluggish economy here. Part of it is because of stricter immigration laws here. But part of it is because the Mexican economy has finally picked up after two decades of mediocre growth. Problem is that that growth is uneven at best. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
Border crossings during the holidays are chaos. In Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, travelers haul truckloads of stuff, from bicycles to lawnmowers and a multitude of toys. Most are going back to Mexico for a long vacation. Others are returning for good, like Ariel Espinosa, a self-employed construction worker from Florida.
The construction business started go down, and I don't see anything to start recover. The old business. I lost one house, cars, and properties.
In good times, Espinosa was making $40 an hour. That's dropped to 12, not enough to pay his bills and support his family. So after 18 years, he's moving back to Mexico.
And as the goal when you move to the United States, the better life, but right now, it's hard.
Mexico's economy is growing at about 4% per year, according to the International Monetary Fund. That makes it one of Latin America's more robust economies. But much of Mexico's growth is concentrated in trade and manufacturing, and these aren't the industries where low-skilled returning migrants are easily absorbed. Most are going back to farming, construction, or to open a small shop at home. Many returnees will face a struggle. At a school in the small town of Pastoria in the central state of Zacatecas, a teacher gives her students a science lesson. Zacatecas has a long history of sending migrants to the United States. But lately, the tide has turned. In the last few years, this school has enrolled 43 new children whose parents moved back from the United States. Magali Lopez Ruiz is the mother of three of those children. They moved from Virginia a year ago after her husband got deported.
Y si a veces sacaba 600, 800 dólares, a veces llegué a sacar hasta 1,000 dólares.
In Virginia, Lopez says she made at least $600 a week cleaning apartments. Now she's unemployed, and her husband works in the fields, making about $10 a day. Other families at the school are in similar situations, barely making ends meet. The benefits of Mexico's economic progress haven't quite reached its rural areas, according to Rodolfo García Zamora. He's an economist who specializes in immigration at the Autonomous University of Zacatecas.
La migración ha sido el mecanismo.
In the absence of domestic opportunities, Mexico's rural working class sees immigration as the only way to get ahead.
That's because returning migrants are going back to a Mexico that's similar to the one they left. Some are lucky. They're returning with savings or to a home they built with remittance money. But half the population in Mexico still lives in poverty. Startup loans are hard to come by, and monopolies in everything from milk to telecommunications discourage budding entrepreneurs. Until those things change, some economists say migration north will likely continue. Back at the school in Pastoria, children blow up balloons to play a game of darts. Those who hold American passports don't plan on staying in Mexico long. One student, Christopher Acosta, says his future is back in the United States.
We're going to go back when we're a little bit more older. Like in high school, we're going to leave.
In Zacatecas, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe for Marketplace.
There's going to be a doubleheader inauguration this year because the 20th of January falls on a Sunday. So a private but official swearing in at noon on the 20th, and then on Monday, the 21st, the whole shebang, fanfare at the Capitol, all of that. 4 years ago this week, though, there was a single word that was being used a lot, carrying through the campaign into the early days of the Obama administration. Hope is what it was. And so now, as we gear up for another 4 years, we've asked people who use words for a living what they think hope means right now. Here's poet Tracy K. Smith.
We dream on our backs, eyes shut to the world. Dreams carry us away, but when we wake from them, we're right back where we were when we lay down. For all but the most exceptional of people, dreams keep us from stirring, from making a peep. I'm tired of dreams. I'm tired of what we mean when we tell kids, particularly the ones who seem to be up against the most insurmountable odds, to dream big. What can dreaming really do to help a person prevail against the many perils of poverty and injustice? And I'm tired of the dream that flickers in the mind's eye whenever anyone alludes to the values this nation was founded upon. How relevant is the notion that hard work is all it takes to get ahead in the era of reality TV, Citizens United, and widespread acceptance of the idea that wealth equals worth? As far as I'm concerned, it's time to wake up. Enter hope, another story altogether. Hope is not about receiving. about being the beneficiary of some nebulous good fortune. It's about putting desire into action. Hope is an idea with an engine. Whenever I hear people disparaging the notion of hope, and I heard it a lot in the years following the 2008 election, I think how used we've gotten to the symbols of action and how far those symbols sit from action itself. Like us on Facebook. And we do. We most certainly do. Then we scroll ahead and disappear back into our private lives. But the hope I'm talking about isn't a symbol. It sits well beneath the surface of language and requires us to unravel what we say, to decode what we are routinely told, to verify what we are only just beginning to think. Moreover, it requires us to keep at it, to remain awake to the world. Hope makes us agents in our own fates. Hope defies us to sit back and wait. It says, buckle down, gather steam. Hope denies us retreat to the dream.
Tracy K. Smith won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry last year. You can read an excerpt from her latest collection. It's called Life on Mars. We've got it at marketplace.org. We're going to be doing the show from Chicago on Friday, by the way, live video streaming at 2, in the place where arguably that hope began for the Obama presidency.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which should pretty much kill any craving for a snack you're having right about now. The Center for Science in the Public Interest is out with its annual list of food porn. That is the fattiest, most caloric meals out there. Topping the charts by a large margin, by the by, is the Cheesecake Factory's Bistro Shrimp Pasta. Get this, 3,120 calories, 89 grams of fat, 1,000 milligrams of sodium, which is, I believe, according to the USRDA, the recommended daily allowance, like what, 4 meals all in one, right? And with that, that is Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow off 23 points, about a tenth percent. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, two-tenths of 1%. The S&P 500 didn't move tall. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.